Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Hans Vodin. As always, before we jump into today's show, I do have to shout out our Patreon. I genuinely believe it's probably the most stacked Patreon out there. We do bonus episodes on bonus episodes pretty much every week. There's two extra episodes that go exclusively on Patreon. We do a bonus Q&A every week, and then we do a whole host of other ones, whether it's a story time with Jonas Lorentzen. We do another variation of that with Claire Moulet once a month, and we do our creator episode, which has been has got a really good reaction so far. A lot of people have loved that. We take a creator from the Viking crafts world. We get them on the show. We'll have a discussion on the main show about what they do, who they are. And then after, we really get into their inspirations, how they do their work. Typically, they'll bring a piece of work to show us and demonstrate live on the show. So yeah, go and check those out. Patreon.com/Nordic Mythology Podcast. It starts from £3 a month, which is literally like buying me a cup of coffee once a month. So yeah, please just have a look if you can. And if you can, a 5-star rating, positive review, wherever you get the podcast does help new people find it, or just like, share on the social medias. It's Nordic Mythology Podcast across the board at this point. But yeah, without further ado, let's get into the main show. Today, I'm joined by Angie Padilla and also Margaret. You're joining us once again. And
hi, guys.
I think it's fun to maybe announce that you're going to be joining more regular.
Yeah, we're trying out every episode in March, and then let's see how it goes.
Yeah, I've bullied you into it.
Oh, you're getting me. You guys are getting me just roped in, aren't you? No, yeah. But I love this. I find it really fun, and especially like getting to talk with people like you, Angie. It's just, I mean, it's a highlight of my week.
Yeah, it's so. Angie, welcome. Thank you for joining us. Do you want to maybe introduce yourself and give a brief overhaul of kind of what we're going to talk about?
I have a broad background, so it's difficult to summarize quickly, but I try because I start with Germanic philology. I study in the University of Pisa, and I graduated in Scandinavian literature and languages. And then my department closed, so for personal reason I couldn't change the city where I live. So I changed my study into communication and cognitive science. And after 1 year, I realized that I love too much the Scandinavian culture. So I focused all my study to force it into Scandinavian studies. And my thesis, bachelor thesis, it was about runes and magic, actually, mostly about Johannes Bureus, that is the first esotericist that work on a magic system with runes. And in my master, I wrote a thesis about a cognitive analysis of mythology. And I use the Runeton as an example on how you can use cognitive science to find information on how was the culture at that time, because the human brain is the same in every culture, in every period, but the way that we process information is changed due to the culture. So see that culture pattern help us to understand how the culture was. I don't know if I explained that.
That's really interesting. Wow.
Yeah. So we're going to focus mainly on the misuse of runes in modern culture, paganism.
Yes, in contemporary paganism. Well, paganism is a very bad word because a lot of people hate it and they don't think that they represent them. But I prefer to use neo-paganism or contemporary paganism because it's kind of an open word that can get used for every different spirituality, because we don't talk about religion, because in religion we have some rules and some political aspect that we have to follow. But from this kind of spirituality, we don't have that. It's more open. And everybody can follow their own feeling and try to figure out their own answers. So this is the good things and also the bad things about this openness. So this is why paganism or heathen could be a 10th century term. So I was focused mostly on how the runes were seen and used and the misconception and the problem of the bad use of runes into this kind of spirituality.
Wonderful. I'm really looking forward to that, because runes are just one thing about this whole area, whatever you want to call it. Anybody who's interested in the Viking Age, Nordic mythology, runes is just the thing that jumps out every time. Whenever we do an episode on runes, it's extremely popular. Whenever through Hornsvoden I do anything relation to runes, it's extremely popular. There is just something about this writing system that seems to grab the kind of minds of people, and I would love to kind of understand why. But then again, it is misused in modern culture, I guess. I see a lot of misinformation out there.
Yeah, it's a very fascinating subject. I also started with this very interesting, very curiosity about what it is, because it's a kind of writing, epigraphic writing mostly, that you're not used today for normal writing. It's not to write letters or poems or to have memories about things in a normal text. Like Latin is have a better graphematic system to write long text, and runes are more epigraphic. So
what would
carve.
That mean? What would that mean in this context? Epigraphic.
That you carve.
Then you carve it. Sure.
Yes,
yeah.
You carve, and so it's more carving. Even if I don't know if you see that behind me, there is the Codex Runicus. So we also have some text, but it is very, very late. So
right,
it is.
Sure.
I have a theory about carving runes, and you can tell me if this is completely wrong or not. But I thought this was groundbreaking when I thought of it. I'm sure other
Look,
people
you're
have.
Already so smug with your little thought.
I'm sure people have already. So obviously, as you know, I carve horns. I made one for you.
Yeah, I can show. I have here.
Sure, yeah. This wasn't just a plug for me, I promise. But
I made this
horn. And I absolutely loved making
it's
this one. This is
enormous.
This
is
one of
so
my
cool.
Favorite ones to make. So I noticed when I do runes, I pretty much exclusively just do Jungafordak, because obviously that fits with the Viking Age. But occasionally I'll get people who ask me to do Eldafordak, and they're so much more difficult to carve because of like the way that the lines go. You get left with a lot of small little pieces that chip and fall out. And I've always wondered whether that maybe could have played part into swapping from Eldafordak to Jungafordak, because you kind of lose those little pieces. Like for example, I think the M rune and the D rune, you kind of get this cross that goes between two lines, which leaves just little pieces that always fall off. I always wondered, and I don't suppose you would know the answer, but that's always been my theory. I've wondered if it played some role into it.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have a proper answer. One of the important things to know is that whatever theory we have, most of the time is, I don't know, but maybe it could be this, and I have this proof to show. But we cannot come back in time. So this theory actually is very interesting. I never thought about that. But
you can use it. It's okay. I'll let you use it.
But I guess it would also really depend on the material that you're working with, right? So I suppose like with horns, it would be one thing, but it would be interesting to see if you get the same results if you were trying to carve in stone or wood.
Yeah.
Because the material behaves differently.
Yeah, this is what experimental archaeologists do it. And I try to do a little bit with my hobby as a reenactor, that we try to do the same things that they do in the past to see if it makes sense. In Ribe, there is the people that live in the old houses all the winter to see how they survive with the cold and what they do. So those experiments are very, very interesting and very, very useful. to have new theories and to figure out things that we cannot know. But I'm gonna think about that because we don't know why from 24 rules they scaled to 16 in the moment where the language became more rich, so more phonemes. I don't know if it's pronounced correctly in English, but the sounds of the letters are more sounds during the Viking Age, but less letters, so it makes it more confusing. Yeah, it could be that someone during the time forget some runes and then they lost during a period, or we don't know.
Maybe I just, you know, came up with the answer. Just a little boy in Huddersfield carving his horns.
Well, I mean, but that's the way research is done, though, right? It's like you're sitting there doing something and then you think of something and you're like, oh, I wonder if...
Exactly. This is how you start to find information, that you have a question to ask yourself and you try to find it, and then you try to prove it, and then you try to read, and then you try to talk to other people.
Yeah, it was just one of those things that I noticed, because I hate carving the elder for that reason. Because, you know, if I spend a bunch of time carving the rest of the horn, and I always tend to do like names last, and when it's in the elder Fulak and you've got to kind of do the name in and little bits fall out, it drives me insane. So it was just, you know, that's my little idea. If you would like to explore it further, I don't mind, as long as you put my name somewhere in it.
Yes, but luckily I didn't ask you to make the connection, because the runes that I asked you to carve is from an historical tablet, a stick, Bergen stick. But the last runes I didn't make you made it in the right way, because it was like a connection runes.
Yeah.
So yeah.
No. I absolutely loved making that horn. It was when somebody sends me a design like that, or like gives me freedom, that's my favorite thing to do, because for the most part I just kind of do the same designs over and over, because people just really like the Helm of Orr and Vegvisir. Like that is by far the most I do, whether it's Viking Age or not. Like people just really like it. But when somebody goes, okay, this is like my rough idea, this is what I want, here you go, have fun. Like that's when I kind of thrive, and I absolutely loved making that. So thank you for commissioning it. I appreciate it.
Can we see it again, Angie? Can we see the horn again?
Oh, you're gonna make me embarrassed.
Yeah, it's a little bit too big for me.
Oh, I'm
this
sorry.
This is amazing.
Because
it looks
I'm
so
short,
good.
But it's the good size for my husband, that is very, very tall. So
God damn,
yeah.
you're like a legit artist, Dan.
Well, you know, come on.
Well is the wrong answer to that compliment.
Thank you very much. Is that the right one?
You're welcome. Yes.
Yeah, I had a lot of compliments for everyone, because it was on the altar while I'm doing, but I did my wedding.
Yeah. No, you know what? Thank you very much. I always find it quite bizarre, but also very flattering when people ask me to make things for weddings. So obviously it's such a big part in somebody's day. Well, it's hopefully the biggest day in most people's lives. And then we, you know, to be a part of that, it's very, you know, it's lovely. And I really like it.
I
enjoy it.
Imagine.
So thank you. Right. Enough about that before I go all red.
But I was curious, Angie, because you mentioned earlier that like you started with getting more and more into kind of, if I remember correctly, like the quote unquote bad use of runes.
Yeah.
And I was just curious. I was just curious because like I'm just very interested in what would you describe, like what would bad mean in the setting?
Exactly. You find exactly my mistake, because bad use is not the correct word.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, Margaret, how dare you?
I did not mean to call it. I mean, inappropriate use?
It could be better, inappropriate, yes, a better word, because the bad is a judge, and I don't like judge people in that sense.
Yeah, that's what I was curious about.
Yeah.
What would that mean?
For me, it's mostly like don't know what it is, but use anyways.
Ah, like that.
Because
Okay.
yeah, I have the idea that if it comes, in the history part, in the linguistic part, you have to be strict, scholarly. You have to study. You have to prove. You have to know things. And in the spiritual part, if you want to use whatever you want to use, is your spiritual path is your own. I think you should be free to do and believe in whatever you want. But the important thing is that you don't use your spiritual beliefs as something historical or share as something that is a fact, because it's not. So for me, it's very, very important that people divide the two things and be clear and honest that this is what I believe, but it's not true. So for me, it's important to know the truth, to study the history, to study the linguistics, to study the fact. And then you can build up your own beliefs that you do at your home alone by yourself.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like, okay, this might be a weird example and not necessarily exactly correct, but I have a rune tattoo. I don't know how easy it is to see, but it's on my forearm here. So quick plug, watch it on YouTube, guys, this episode
Nice.
from the Oseberg ship. Now I am an archaeologist, so it was important to me to kind of get this checked out, and we had a talk with a runologist before we got it done. But my point being that, like, I got those runes tattooed knowing that we don't know for sure what this is, but I think it looks cool, so I'm going to get it tattooed anyway. But it's not like I think that this means something specifically, and then it turns out to say, like, horseshit or something. I'm aware that we're unsure of what this means.
Yeah, it is what I mean. If when you know, you can do whatever you want. If you do something only because it's beautiful to look, it's fine. As soon as you don't create and invent things like these runes means this and it's not true. You can say these runes for me, it remember me this meaning, so I'm attached with that for this reason. And
Exactly.
this complete honest, that's gonna be right for you to do it.
Yeah.
We discovered last week, Margaret, that we have the same tattoo.
Yes, we do apparently.
I have the same runes across my
Really?
ear. So,
This is interesting.
it
We are
was.
both
I was going to
nerds.
say it was fate that we would end up doing the podcast, but we are nerds, yes. No, I couldn't agree more because I am always a big advocate of the truth and for people to be like, this is true. I don't care what you do in your own time or what you want, have fun with stuff. We're in the modern era. You can kind of play around with things. That doesn't bother me, but don't then put it forward as being historically accurate. And that's always been something I've very, very much been strongly opinioned on, I guess, that you need to differentiate between the two. And when people then start to blur the lines, it frustrates me a little bit because it's like other people are going to look at this, and this probably leans into a lot with runes, that you get a lot of stuff put, particularly on Facebook. I talk about Facebook every week and the Facebook groups. But you get so much information put on there that other people don't know any better, and they just kind of see it and take it to be true and just assume that somebody else has done the research when in reality they haven't.
It's very problematic because, for my experience at least, sometimes people doesn't want to know the truth. And they're kind of pissed off when you tell, actually, this is not this is that. And maybe you say in an honest way, because nobody knows things since the beginning. Obviously, you have to learn. I also have to learn so many things that I'm still learning. But they became angry. Like, I don't know why. And I think sometimes they prefer the idea than the truth. And I don't understand, because for me, the truth, the history is so much more amazing than every weird idea of magic or spirituality or whatever.
Margaret, go, I can see you.
I had a thought that, like, this, I might be off base here, but I'm just thinking that I get also, because I've had those experiences too, Angie, like when I've disseminated my research and I've kind of like come up with results that maybe doesn't align with what people's idea or imagination of pre-Christian Scandinavia or the Viking Age. And I just find it really sad that I don't find it sad that they disagree, but I find it sad that it seems to me like it's taken so personally,
Yes.
and that I've somehow like touched something in them that hurts. So I think, like, I mean, not to toot our horns here, Angie, but that's exactly what I'm going to do. Where it's like, I think exactly for that reason, unfortunately, research like ours is important, because I think it's important to keep having a conversation about what we figure out about how life maybe was and what how things were used, maybe, even though a modern perception might be different, and even though it might be a personal kind of feeling to some people. Because to me, I got kind of sidetracked there, but my point was that I find it unfortunate that it hurts people, because I'm like, I understand that this is personal to you, and I don't want to like step on that. But at the same time, just because it's personal to you doesn't mean that you're allowed to dictate the narrative.
I understand that. Sometimes I feel like sorry to tell it to you, and it's crazy. But at the same time, I think that if you really, really love this subject, you can be a little bit disappointed in the beginning, but then you realize that it's better than you thought. And it's interesting. Also, we don't know everything. And so it's a subject that always can find new answers and new questions, mostly questions than answers. But I think that the biggest problem is that sometimes there is a lack of communication from the academia to the public domain.
Oh yeah, 100%.
And it's important for people like you that do this service for people, to help them to connect with academia, because we really need that. And now that we have so much information online, people don't know how to distinguish what is truth and what is not. They don't know. And I found very interesting in university, the first thing that I learned is how to find out the right sources. And it's the first thing that they ask me, how I can figure out what is a good book and what is a bad book, because everyone could present themselves in a great way. And sometimes people are attached of strong people that present themselves in a certain way, and they look amazing, and they say, I did this, I did that. But maybe they didn't really study, and it's just an Instagram filter. I don't know how to express it. Because study and find information is difficult, it's hard. And most of the people don't like to do that, and they prefer to have a guide that they say what to do. Most spiritual part is most difficult, because a lot of people doesn't know what to do, because we don't have sorry, my English is horrible. I'm making a mistake
every
word.
You're doing great. No,
it's fine.
But like, we don't have a guidebook, right? We don't have a rule book telling us how it works.
We don't have a Bible that is say you have to pray this God in this way, you have to do this and that. We don't have that. And people usually, when it comes from Christianity, that we have, because Occidental culture is Catholic, but in some ways, or Christians, and so we have a kind of mindset. Even if we don't believe in that, we have this kind of mindset of a religion with a guy with rules and everything. And when they don't find those things, when they don't find a book or information on how the rites were done and everything, they feel lost. And what they do to someone that say, oh, they did this, this, and that, and I know because my grandparents knew that, and I have this tradition since the debugging age. And they say, oh, this is amazing, I'm going to follow you. Just because they pretended they know since the past, but it's not like that. We don't have that.
Yeah, I had a discussion about with someone on Facebook again. About
you need to stop. No, not Facebook again.
I should do something. But because you see this a lot with like people claiming their lineage. There was a guy claiming his lineage like all the way back to basically he must have had some lineage back to the Normans and was like, I could change my lineage back all the way to the Normans. That means I'm Viking in some way. And then I was like, okay, well, I'd love to see like the pathway you can track back 1,000 years, because that's really impressive if you can track your lineage way all the way back that way. And he was like, yeah, well, you know, a lot of it's oral. And I'm like, well, there's the hiccup,
the
isn't
thing
it?
Is, yeah, because I had when Angie mentioned that, I had a similar caveat where it's like there's this funny, it's kind of like a stereotype, but also from my personal experience, kind of true, where many people from the Trøndelag area of Norway will claim that they can trace their lineage back to Olav Tryggvason, one of the like hero kings from the sagas, because he was supposedly from Trøndelag. And it's kind of like a ha-ha thing in pop culture. Like, yeah, every Trønder is like somehow related to Olav Tryggvason. But the problem with that is that there is one thing is like, yeah, we have oral stories, but then you can't back it up. And it's not like you can't, I mean, in some areas you could probably prove things even though it wasn't written down, but we didn't start keeping, not like you Brits over there with all your documentation, like you cannot go back to the Viking Age in Scandinavia and kind of with certainty trace lineages, because that just wasn't how it worked. We don't have any type of documentation to clarify that. And then you also have that big issue with like, well, how do we know that this document is right, you know? But on a personal note, a former friend of mine who I studied with, he was also from Trøndelag, and we had a conversation about this exact like stereotype of like every Trønder saying that they're from Olav Tryggvason's family. And he completely deadpan, completely seriously, he went like, yeah, that's funny, but like my family actually is descended from Olav Tryggvason. And I just went, what? And he was like, no, like we are. And I'm like, but we can't, we just talked about how we can't trace that. And he was just like, no, he wouldn't budge. Yeah. And I was like, you know what, bro, if this is your alternate reality, that's fine. You go ahead thinking that, but I know that it's, you can't prove it.
Yeah. You know, Kaylee just said in the chat, and so it might be not that it's just individual people, that maybe it's the actual websites that do the lineage, because she said she did one and it came back actually saying that she was related to Ragnar and Auslaug.
But you can't possibly know that because we don't have that skeletal material.
Exactly. but if the genealogy website is saying that to people, then people...
Yeah, that's a maybe, cash grab, guys.
Yeah, so then maybe people are just taking that as being like, oh, I paid for this service. They clearly must know what they're doing.
No.
But so yeah, it's kind of shitty if that's been put out there and it's not backed up. But yeah, the amount of people who claim to be from Ragnar. But to kind of get it back on topic, that's the same kind of thing you find with runes. And I wanted to touch on this before when we were talking about why people get so upset. And I think it's probably a similar thing. Once you start getting people's identity into it, and a lot of people on the surface who are interested in all of this stuff, they don't have the time to really delve in. They don't have the time to really read all of the books. As much as maybe they want to, life gets in the way. So they just see, again, to mention Facebook, unfortunately, I think there's a lot of places where people get a lot of information from. They'll join the different Viking style groups, and then their feeds will just be flooded with information that's inaccurate, but they don't have the time to research any further, so they kind of just take what's there to be true. And then I think with runes in particular, a lot of people get these tattooed. You see it time and time again, people saying, can you translate this? So I want to get it tattooed into something. It's like people's names, they want to get like loved ones' names tattooed. So I think when you have that whole aspect, then when you come along and go, oh yeah, by the way, that thing you got tattooed isn't real or isn't correct, automatically people's defenses go up, because it's a hard thing to kind of then go, oh yeah, this thing that's on me forever is wrong, and to admit that. And also, like, aside from just tattooing, when people put so much emphasis and spirituality into something, and particularly in like the rune magic side of things, to then accept that everything you've maybe been doing for the last 5 years is incorrect. It takes a big person to do that. It's much easier to just go put like your blinkers on and go, nah, fuck you. I'm not listening to you. Like, what I learned is right, and just shut out the accurate information. It takes a real big person, an introspective person, to then go, oh, maybe I am wrong. And I just don't think people are willing to.
Yeah. The most difficult thing, and I think that I appreciate a lot, is when a person admit a mistake, because everybody can do a mistake. Everybody could be naive in the beginning. And if you learn and realize, it's a good thing. You realize, you learn something, you're better. So admit a mistake shouldn't be a bad thing, but online, no, doing this is really bad, because online, unfortunately, when you admit that you made a mistake, people attack you.
Yeah,
there's no like grace. There's no grace period for like, or compliments for like, hey, good on you, you learned.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it means that you made a mistake, you don't know anything. That's it.
Yeah, we're all, that is one of my absolute bugbears, is that humans should be learning their entire life. You know, I'm a much different person now than I was last year, let alone 10 years ago. And I've learned a lot, and a lot of things I thought 10 years ago are completely wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to say that, because I've learned and grown as a human. But then when people do it online and learn, it's shut down as if it's a negative thing.
I feel like that also entirely depends on the community that you're in.
Yeah.
But like, when it's like on an open forum, the likelihood of you getting attacked and like getting kind of just slandered for even admitting that you were wrong is much greater. And I think therefore it's also like a bigger risk to admit that. But I was thinking about like that, what you said about it taking a bigger person than to kind of admit that. I'm also wondering, and I'm curious to see if you agree with me, Angie, because I don't really have anything to back this up, but just this is just based on my personal experience from when I was in school and then to becoming a researcher and kind of disseminating my research, was that I have a feeling, since this isn't something that I've been able to prove, but I have a feeling that a lot of those negative reactions, for example, to new discoveries about runes, seems to me to be connected to how we are taught that history functions too. And what I mean by that is that we're taught that in the Stone Age, they did this. And in the Viking Age, they did this. There's like no kind, like, personally, at least, I didn't experience a lot of nuance when I was taught history. Like, there wasn't a lot of, oh, so in the Stone Age, we have like these traces of things, so we're pretty sure that they used axes for this and this and this. Or like in the Viking Age, we have traces of brooches, so we think that they had dresses that were held up by brooches. So like, you learn that history was like a, this is how it was in the past,
yeah,
period. And then if you've then been misinformed about, for example, runes, someone that has like quote unquote more authority than you coming along saying, well, actually that's incorrect, then that kind of destroys part of how you feel like history functions.
Yeah, I think it's the problem that I talk with a friend about this, because I'm a person that always want to be certain when I say something. And I was very honest that we don't know that could be that. And a friend of mine told me that if you continue to say we don't know and then explain what we know, it sounds like you don't know enough. You're not very authoritative. Is the right word, right? And people that are more certain and say it was like that, other people that maybe didn't have this background of studies follow more a person that seems more certain out there, of their knowledge. They look more knowledgeable. And
I think that's really unfortunate.
Yeah.
I was actually, I was taught, luckily for me, I was taught the complete opposite when I started working as a guide in an archaeological museum. My boss, one of the first things she told me, she was like, if you get a question and you don't know the answer to it, answer, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because she wanted to teach the kids like, oh, now you're with an expert in a museum. And if the expert says, I don't know, then you're also allowed to not know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a very good point of view. Yeah, I like this.
Yeah, I
Because I
know.
think that that's unfortunate that like the only people that others will listen to are the certain people. Because I think, but then that makes history really boring because there's so much stuff we don't know, and that's where research comes from.
It's a tough one. I've always said in the past, like, I respect when people come on this podcast and they'll openly say, I don't know that, or we don't know that, because I guess as a scholar coming on here, most they feel the pressure to be here to explain things. And I always have so much more respect when people are like, I'm not sure about that, or I don't know how that works. And I think it's such a good mindset to give people.
Yeah.
So let's try to
Like,
get
I'm
some.
not sure, like, how do you feel about that, Angie? Like,
About the people that don't be honest.
yeah, just like the how to. I mean, it's a difficult question. I empathize with you so much in
Yes.
like having a hard time
I'm always
communicating.
open. I'm always honest, and I always say if I don't know or if I'm not sure. And sometimes, even if I'm sure, maybe I don't remember where it comes from, so I prefer to say I don't know and take a look because I'm the opposite. I'm too much. I want to be too precise, and sometimes this is a problem. But yeah, I think that in the academia part, I see more honestly than in the Facebook page where people seems to have all the answer. I don't know how.
Yeah, no, I don't. So let's get more specific, and should we start with what we do know about rune magic, maybe?
Yeah.
Historically, from like a historical point of view, like what we know, and then we can then kind of delve into how that's then been maybe misused in like the modern era.
The thing is that some people think about runes and connect it immediately to magic. But the thing is that there is two kind of study, runes magic and runes as a linguistic writing system, and usually they don't collide. But the basic and the truth is that we don't have any proof that runes have a magical things in it in themselves. Like the runes itself is not magical, or we don't know. We don't have any proof of that. But we have proof of runes used for magic, like curses or apotropaic amulets. Yeah. So we have those. We
So,
use. Sorry?
would that be the runes used to physically write out, like, say, a
Yeah.
curse, or in some way to
Yes.
write out like a magical
Yes.
connotation, rather than the physical rune
Yeah,
being?
the rune itself as magic is we don't have proof of that. But we have proof of runes used for curses and amulets and all
Yes,
this stuff.
like a combination of
Yes.
runes. Use,
Yes.
yeah.
Because we but this is for every alphabet. We have the Diphixiones in Greece, and we have abracadabra, so we use all the alphabets for magic. It's not something that is only for the runic writing, and runic the runes are used in pre-Christian beliefs, but also for Christianity. A lot of invocation and inscription about that. But yeah, so this is the first thing. So we kind of prove that runes in itself has a magical value, even if we have proof that they're used in magical aspects. So we the most used thing is the name of the runes as magic. Like the runes has a name, so this is the meaning, the magical meaning of the runes. But we know that those names arrived very late, and the name of Eldar Futhark are reconstructed. So I'm not gonna go deep in that, but we know those things. We think that probably it was a nanotechnical, like to memorize the names, the runes, the
yeah.
order, because obviously Futhark is the order of the runes, because we have alphabets, that is alpha, beta, and then we have Futhark, that is the first, the transliteration are the first six runes, because every rune has a phonological meaning after it.
So kind of like when you're at school and you're trying to like remember something, you're told to almost like
elephant.
kind of make a story out of it. I think probably the most famous one is like remembering the order of the planets. Like my very easy method just speeds up naming planets. That's what I was taught. So like you make like a sentence. Have you never heard that? Well, I guess I don't know if how the
no,
planets.
I had the book where you said A, Ape, B, Bicicleta.
Okay. Yeah.
You have the letter and the word that start with that letter.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I always remember the one. I remember that one for planets. But yeah, so that's that. I think that's the only one I really remember. But that's the kind of, I guess that's the kind of thing. So that's the idea behind the name of the rune, that it was a way to remember, which would make sense because we still use that technique today.
Yeah, exactly. Also, we're not sure about this is an hypothesis.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, so the first letter for the first word, except for two runes, but for the rest, we have like Algis and Ingwats, because they don't have. We don't have words that start with ng or with sed. And then we have a problem about the origins of runes, where they come from. I try to go quickly because maybe it's something that everybody already know.
No, I think this is really cool. Yeah.
Because we have different theories.
Don't worry about going too quick. Like I say, every podcast is somebody's first podcast, and hopefully there is somebody jumping in here for the first time. So don't worry about explaining things that you think maybe people already know, because you know I've talked about this topic so much, and I forget stuff and need remembering. So if I need it, then I'm sure tons of other people will also appreciate that kind of retelling.
So we don't know where the runes come from, because we have the idea that obviously they have a system where they copy, or where they have the idea and they use it. And they have different theories, the Latin theory, the Greek theory, and the Etruscan, is English.
Etruscan?
Etruscan, yes.
Yeah.
theory. So in different periods, they have different theories, and now they think that could be a mix of different letters together, because some letters have they look
looking
the same,
they look similar,
but they have different sound, or maybe they have the different sound that they look different, but they look different. So
no, but that makes sense, because like we've seen that with a lot of other things from the Viking Age, where they've taken elements that comes from somewhere else and then they've kind of adopted it into their own use. So that would make sense that they would do that with these symbols as well.
Exactly. And I think that it is funny that the theory about the Etruscan theory, North Etruscan phonetics, is come from a Norwegian archaeologist that in the 1928, I think, he found this helmet of Negau. I hope it's pronounced that, because it's from Slovenia. And where is there is an inscription on it that is look like runes, but it's not runes. And it says Hare Gasti Taiva. And I don't know if you know this, but in the beginning of the concert of the Heilung group, they scream Hare Gasti Taiva. And it comes from this helmet.
I had no idea.
I found very interesting this.
Yeah.
But that's so cool. Like, but that is then written in Etruscan then? Or is it like what? So what is, since they aren't ruins, then what is?
It's Etruscan.
Yeah, it is Etruscan, yeah.
And it looks like ruins. This is why my son, the archaeologist, made the connection. Maybe it could be from this language the ruins survived.
Yeah.
And we're not sure about what this means. In the beginning, they thought that that is an invocation of the old version of the god Tyr, Teiva, like a god. But now most people believe that it's like this helmet is Arigasti helmet.
Yeah. So this is this person or this people's helmet. Yeah.
So this is why I don't know why Heilung screamed that in the beginning of the concert, but it is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, cool. Use of the past and the present. That's cool. Do you remember which archaeologist was the first one to make that connection?
I'm sorry for the pronunciation, but
don't
it's
worry about it.
Written Mastrander. Mastrander. Maybe I can write
Mastrander.
It.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've heard of him. Because like when you said the Norwegian archaeologist, like, I'm pretty sure I've read something about this person, probably. which one are we talking about? That's cool. Yeah.
Okay, come back to the magic. We don't know also the meaning of the name Runa, what it means runes. And we have some ideas like a secret message or whisper, a secret wisdom. Well, we have those weird things that maybe people connected with magic. So they say, oh, this term, it means something magical. Mm-hmm. And the first rune inscription where we find rune as a term for the letters, for the writing characters, is from the Einland stone that is in Norway from the 5th century. Well, we know that the runes usually are dated. The first finding of runes for sure is the Vimose camp. That is from 160 AD, you found in Denmark, where it's written Haria. But also some people believe that the Fibula of Meldorf, dated around 150 AD, is runes. Other people doesn't believe that it's runes. So we're not sure about that. But we know that when we have a finding of a writing, usually it takes, there is a gap from when the writing system is created since we have the first finding. So we think that we have around 200 years earlier. And then obviously we found the oldest runic stone runes in 2021. I think they found it, but it was last year.
Yeah, the Sigurd stone. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but there is a lot more to discover.
Definitely.
Yeah, and the runes, you know, they have a those prophetic, again, English is correct, if I made a mistake in English, because I know any time, those prophetic is the way that they write from left to right and then right to left, or maybe from up down, that they write in this way.
So like a snake-like.
Yeah. They didn't write in the same way, but they change the direction of the writing with runes.
Yeah, you know what, Angie? I can't even pronounce that word, so don't worry about
it. Prophetic.
I can't say it, so
it's probably I can't even either. So it's probably correct.
Because in Italian, it's bustroferico, but I think it's bustroferic in English.
I knew what you meant. So it's basically like a snake type. So you're writing from left to right, right to left, left to right, right to left, all up to down, down to up, up to down, up to up.
Exactly.
Which I've always found very fascinating, because you see people who say, oh, if you write a rune backwards, it has the negative meaning. And I've always been like,
I think it's connected with the tarot cards, where you can reverse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that is one of these misconceptions that's really popular. People will believe that if you write a rune backwards, it's reverse meaning to what the meaning is, I guess.
Really? I've never heard that before.
I did something very bad many years ago. I maybe shouldn't say that, but I think it's kind of funny.
Yeah, we're here for that.
It's a little bit mean, but it's funny. So I'm in a group of pagan people. A person was very worried because they extracted a rune, and apparently they extracted upside down, and they were so worried and say, "What I can do? I extracted upside down," and I answered, "Well, just turn it."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just turn it and you're good.
Just turn it. It's not upside down anymore.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
But that's true, and that's whenever I see this said online, that's the example that I always give, is that they're written. I think it's Bustrophodon in English, but I don't know if that's the right pronunciation either. But yeah, this idea that they're written forwards and backwards. So like clearly, it can't have had some terrible, weird, negative connotation to write backwards. It's just how it was.
Yeah, I think this idea it comes from tarot, because the divination comes from tarot. The guy that invented the blank rune, I don't know if you know that, they usually have this package of runes that they sell with a blank rune that is called the rune of Odin or the rune of fate or something like that. That actually, I don't know how you can invent a rune that is blank, because then here is a lot of blank runes.
Yeah,
how you can write that. But yeah, it was invented from in the 1982 from Ralph Blum. Blum?
Blum. Yeah.
Blum. And yeah, he didn't know anything about runic, but he found these pieces, and it was this blank rune that it was like actually two exchanges if someone lose one. And he invented this system,
oh,
like,
right.
oh, maybe this is another rune, so we can make this system of magic divination.
I can just
okay.
tell that both Dan and I are both just simultaneously like, oh no.
Yeah. Okay, so before we kind of get into modern times, the misuse, because I think we've wrapped up pretty
yes.
well.
Sorry.
So we've wrapped up pretty well that runes in and of themselves aren't magical. The actual rune, it's that they've maybe been written, used to write out some sort of, whether you want to call it incantation or some sort of curse. So they've been used in, I guess, a magical purpose, but as a writing source, not as a physical like little rune. So before we get to like the modern time, the question or the thing that's always sat in my mind is this idea and story of Odin sacrificing himself to himself for kind of like the power of the runes and to understand it. And that, to me, that story kind of screams some sort of magical connotation. Because you know he's obviously sacrificing himself. I guess he doesn't die, which is somewhat magical. And the idea of that he's learning this power that other people don't possess, it kind of has a whole magical feel to it. And that's the one hang up I've always had with this sort of topic. And I wondered your opinion on that and how you felt that kind of fit into it.
Is one of my favorite parts of the mythology. This actually is the one that I wrote my master on. The thing is that from what we know, there is a new theory actually about how much illiterate or not are in the during the Viking Age. But the common idea is that not a lot of people know how to write you runes, how to write and read,
Okay.
and we know from the text that the Skald people, they were considered like magical, with magical power, because the words, they can forge the words to create a poem, so it was like a
Right, yeah.
magical connotation, because with the words you can create the reality. So yeah, the writing is kind of powerful, because you know how to put on an object a text, and a
Permanently,
text has an effect. And the writing, actually, there is a lot of mythologies where the writing is given by the gods to the people, and we have also some some runes stone that say that the runes comes from the gods, the powerful runes, and they evoke the power of the runes. So the runes has a power. But this doesn't necessarily mean that the runes has a power in on itself, but it's a power that you can use it to produce something. So it's the intention where how you use it that have an effect. If you write some random letters, you don't understand. But if I write an insult to you and you understand, they have an effect to you. Mm-hmm. So yeah, runes can be powerful, but it's the way that you use, I think. And the sacrifice of Odin is very interesting because I think that is a kind of, because we know that myth could be a prototype of mythological prototype that people can reproduce for ritual purpose. And it is a kind of interesting topic because it's kind of teaching you that you have to sacrifice to it's not that rules you can learn to wake up and you know those. You have to sacrifice, you have to study, you have to do a lot of things to arrive there. So I think it's a concept that has a meta level of reading, because you can have the narrative, you can have the ritual aspect, you can have the spiritual aspect, and you can have the practical aspect. This could be reproduce this kind of ritual, but also learn a behavior, a cultural mindset, how you learn, how you arrive at some point in your life.
Mm-hmm. I love when a guest says something and there is an absolute aha moment that happens in my head. And because that's literally just what happened. Like, I've been thinking about this for so long. And then when you said about how obviously not many people could write and the being able to would be, I'm just like, oh my God, I'm so thick. How have I not thought of that before? It's so obvious that if you have, I don't know, I'm just pulling numbers out my ass, but like 1 in 100 people can write. Of course, that person is going to be seen as somewhat magical and special, because this is something that not everyone can do, and it's so unique and not everybody can. And again, that's kind of switching the mindset from the modern day of like, oh, everyone can just read and write, it's very obvious, and actually putting yourself back
but
a
even
years
that
ago.
Everyone being able to read and write is very, very new. You know, and it's still not a global thing, and it isn't that long ago either, just in Western cultures, that being able to read and write was then gave you the label of being a learned person, just for the sake of being able to read and write. So that makes it, but I had the same thought, Dan, that I was like, of course, and I really liked that that parallel that you drew with the sacrifice of Odin, where it's like, not like you necessarily have to die to achieve knowledge, but it's like if you want to learn something. I really like that example that you made, Angie, where you were just like, it's not like you're just going to wake up and know the runes all of a sudden, but you need to put in time and effort and you need to study.
Yeah.
And so you're sacrificing time and energy and a lot of brain power, probably. I remember how difficult it was to learn how to read and write.
Yeah, it is. It is.
It's really difficult.
I still don't know if I've properly learned. So, I haven't throwing this fact out here on the podcast for a while, but I definitely have in the past, but I'm going to read it. Do you know why British pubs have the little pictures, the little hanging signs? You know, like the iconic British pub would have has the little hanging sign outside. This is my little bit of information.
I'm not sure if I understand what you're asking. Sorry.
So like a pub would have like a sign of, I don't know, like a boar's head or like a beer.
Oh, typically like a red lion. Like, so you'd have a pub, and then there would be like a sign that attaches to the side of the pub, and
like a picture that would be hanging outside.
Like the name of the pub would be like on a almost like a hanging billboard.
I don't know.
Because people couldn't read or write. So they would put the picture of the pub the picture of the name of the pub on a little on a little board outside. And when I learned
I was
that,
completely lost.
When I learned that, I was fascinated by it, because obviously it's a very, I don't know if they do that in other countries, but it's certainly like a very British thing that like most pubs, especially old pubs, have like a, it is almost like those little A-frame boards that stand on the outside but just hang from the side of the pub with, say, the Red Lion. It's got a picture of the Red Lion on, or the Hare and Hounds is a popular one. And apparently, yeah, it's because people, you know, not going back that far into the probably the Victorian era, didn't or couldn't read or write. So they're like, oh, we're going to the Red Lion because there's a little picture of a red lion up there. But I've said that on this podcast many times in the old days. So, but any, for any new listeners, there's a little bit of new information for you.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Thank you.
You know, I do have some little bit.
It is a fun factoid.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it is. It is. Okay, so we've kind of cleared up the Odin hanging thing, which again was one thing that always intrigued me and I never really had an answer for. So yeah, I really appreciate that. So let's go into more modern times. Do we know when or where or who really attached magic to the individual rune? Because you see, I think there are probably more books out there that are called like, ooh, rune magic and divination than there actually are for accurate books.
Yeah.
Why are you sniggering, Margaret?
No, I was just sniggering at, like, if I go into a bookstore and I see the magic of runes and I'm like, I'm not buying that book, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was just some of my prejudice bleeding through. I apologize, guys.
But there are more of those books. And again, I do the same. I would always steer away from the rune magic divination books. And I always tell people to. And I always point people towards probably Runes a Handbook by Michael P. Barnes. Like, that's the one that I would say.
Yeah, that is very good.
That's probably like the best one.
The best introduction. It is the one I also recommend.
But unfortunately, there are way more magical books. So do we know where that came from? The point.
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, wow. I wasn't expecting
that's
that
great.
Answer.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, podcast over. Let's all go home.
Well, she needs to tell us first.
We know, because it's the question that I asked myself when I did my bachelor. As I said, runes were used for magic, but the first esoteric system as a system in itself, it comes from the 1600 from Johannes Bureus, that he was an esotericist, and he was one of the first philologists. He started to study runes. It's the period where the goddesses arrived, so in Scandinavia, people wants to come back to the sources, to find antiquarianism, like they collected the old manuscript, they collected old runes, they tried to figure out, and the idea was a political purpose, because they want to show that their culture was old, and since it was old, it was precious, it was more important. They want to trace their status, their lineage, since Magog and Noah from the Bible, they want to say that the first king was Swedish and all this stuff. So it was to prove that their country was the most important one and the most Catholic one. But at the same time, they tried to collect the antiquarianism. So this was the most important period, because it thanks to that that we have most of the rune stones that some are lost, written thanks to Olive Orm, the brothers Magnus, or Johannes Bureus. These three are the most important and first to do this work. But I can start and not finish. So I try to focus on the magic. Bureus created the first esoteric system. And his idea was to connect with the Kabbalah and the Gematria. So every rune has a number and has a meaning. And he created a system with a cross that you have to go through this, steps to arrive to the spiritual, to the God, to connect with the divine. So the runes were a means of communication with the divine, a way to be a better person, to to ascend as a person, as a spirit. But at the same time, only few people can know this spiritual meaning of the runes, because he think that they have three levels of runes. And there was the runes that everybody understands, so the written ones, and then the magical, and then the spiritual. So it's like some levels, and only few people, only the chosen one can understand it.
So very Scientology.
It's very weird. It's a very weird guy. and I try to understand most of his theories, but they're very cryptic, very, very cryptic.
That would make sense, though, for it to be a bit like, ooh.
Yeah, exactly. But it started from him. And then, yeah, we have a lot of people that start to make an idea. Like, they try to figure out the truth, but at the same time, in the beginning, they connected a lot of runes with magic, with some myth, like the runes were come from the primordial with the giants. So history were still with myth in that period. It takes time to figure out the difference. And another person that is very famous still today is Sigurd Aggren. Sorry again for the pronunciation, I'm not sure. That in the 30s, he invented the Uthak. And it's the system where the first letter of the Uthak, it moved to the end. Because for some reason, he decided that this that the real sequence, the sequence for priests, for important people who knows the real runes, they put the first in the beginning to trick others. So the real one, it was Uthak.
Okay.
Oh, people are just funny, aren't they? They just want to make things special to them. That's all it is. It's somebody who wants to feel special, so he's like, oh, you know what? Only I know the real answer. They lied to us. This should have been at the end. And it's just that kind of complex of somebody who's
but
like...
But best use this today. A lot of esotericists or spiritual people still use this, still believe this.
Yeah, it is that... I think humans have always... We are such creative creatures that I think we've always wanted to be unique and different. And I think that's probably kind of almost innate in us to want that individuality. So I think that kind of plays into things like this where people see something that's different and they'll go, okay, that's the right one. And then attach themselves to it because it's just different to the other.
It just feels good, you know? It feels right. It feels correct.
Yeah, but I think it is just a human nature, and obviously it is frustrating when it results in inaccurate information being put out there, but I think it is, again, you know, just a very typical human nature thing to be like, oh, I just want to try and be different. I want to take my own path. You know, it's also why so much innovation has happened, because people take their own routes.
Yeah, but I think, like, I'm not to be that person, but I'm going to be that person. I think that's also a very stereotypical Western idea of what human nature is.
Okay, maybe, yeah.
Because we have much more of an individualistic chosen one. I'm the sun around which the universe rotates type of mentality that isn't necessarily, like, in the modern sense, anyway.
Okay.
That was a caveat. Yeah, yeah. But you said then, Angie, that like this esotericism kind of like magic, if would it be correct to call it like a magicification of runes, starts with, what were those names again that you said?
Johannes Bureus was the first.
Johannes Bureus, yep.
Yes.
And then Sigurd.
He's Swedish.
Yep.
Yeah. And then we have a lot of people that connect runes with.
But who's that second guy that you mentioned?
Oh, the second is Sigurd Aggret.
We'll write them in either we'll put them in the show notes, which is the little bit that attaches to the podcast. If anyone who's downloaded the podcast, if you look in the little bit that has the description on them, we'll put them in there so you can get the names. And also, Angie, either now or after the podcast, if you want to write them in the chat for the patrons, because I know they've been asking. It can wait, don't worry.
Okay.
I was just curious.
I'm very bad in technology.
let them wait until the end. They can wait until
We'll
the
do it in the
Q&A.
question part.
Yeah, they can, you know, like they're patient bunch. Okay, so we know roughly where this magic thing started. Why do you think it caught fire so much? And then also, it's all as much as it pains me to say, it's almost just become the more popular theory, and it probably is. I think, unfortunately, most people now think of this idea of runes being magical, particularly like just the layperson, the general public, the average Joe.
I'm gonna stop you right there, Dan. I think that might be a very big popular thing outside of Scandinavia. I don't think I've ever met a
Maybe.
Scandinavian person that immediately connects runes with magic necessarily in Scandinavia. I think the more
Maybe,
Scandinavian people are like, oh, well, that's the way we wrote before we got the Latin alphabet.
yeah. But I think for the most part, the people that are interested in this whole thing, there is such a huge amount of people in
Oh,
the US,
sure, definitely.
in like North America, in
Yeah.
particular, in the UK. Like, unfortunately, I would say most people outside of Scandinavia. I know. I would say most people do unfortunately have this attachment of magic to runes. Again, particularly anybody who doesn't do any further reading, because for most part, most books that are worth any salt, any are worth their weight in, whatever the term is, worth their weight in salt, usually it's prefaced quite early on in the book, the fact that runes aren't attached to magic. Any book I've read typically puts that in there quite early. So yeah, what do we have any idea as to why it just caught fire? That's the long way of putting that question.
Why it is very famous, the magical part. I think that is the most easy and probably the most right thing is that all the people like magic, all the people like mystery.
Okay.
It's kind of sexy, isn't it? Interesting.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
since it's not a kind of writing that we used to use and it's not used anymore for normal writing, it has this aura of magic because it's a mystery. We don't know what it means. We see some
Yeah.
sign and it seems, oh, this is cool. What it is, maybe it's magic. Yeah, and it's kind of, my professor usually had this joke that maybe in 2000 years, our society doesn't exist anymore. Someone arrived from another planet and find a penis designed everywhere in graffiti of penis, and they say,
Penis?
yes,
Yep.
that.
Oh,
And then
now I'm
maybe
listening.
it's
It's
something magical
yeah,
because
ritual.
it's everywhere.
And really,
Yeah.
it's just people drawing dicks. You can't give me a pen and paper, and I'm not gonna draw a dick. Believe me, it's just I don't know if it's a guy thing, but like
Very 12-year-old mentality, Dan. I applaud it.
if I get a pen and paper in front of me, if you leave that, and I'm gonna start doodling. Dicks are coming out, and I cannot help it. I don't know why, it just happens. So, I mean, yeah, if aliens come down and fight, yeah, you don't know. And before you said that, I was also thinking that how in like any movie ever, or any like popular culture thing, TV show, if they're ever discussing anything that's either maybe a little bit occult or magical,
They'll use the term rune.
they always pop runes in
Yeah.
there. You'll always see it put there. Even it also you see it with like satanic stuff as well. Usually, like there'll be a rune painted somewhere in the background, just added into all of this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, but a writing where that you don't understand it is has an effect of mystery, and you connect immediately with magic. There is a lot of people also when I don't know, maybe you didn't, probably yes, but when you're younger, maybe sometimes you try to create a secret alphabet to communicate with other people.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's common.
Oh, I did that. I definitely did that. Yeah, definitely. Like trying to
And
make your own like secret
yeah,
little writing
exactly.
system.
Because even if you have like a weird kind of writing that you don't understand, but it's still used today, you know that it's still used. So it's not so cool as something that nobody understands normally.
Yeah,
because I was also thinking about that popular culture aspect, because I was thinking how not even like actual elder or younger Futhark runes themselves, but the word rune, it suddenly pops up as a synonym for a kind of occult symbolic based language in like fantasy or like games. So not even actual runes, but like two off of the like off the top of my head are like World of Warcraft and this young adult fantasy series that is like one of my guilty pleasures, not gonna lie, like the Shadowhunter series.
But also in the
term rune.
Wicca, unfortunately, also the Wicca, when it comes like a fashion, like with Cunningham, Scott Cunningham, when he wrote a book about Wicca, he created some runes and he called them runes, and they are not runes. So it became a popular culture for those people that take those things and use it for their spiritual beliefs or purposes.
Yeah, so like the term rune just kind of becomes synonymous with like this magical written language. Which then doesn't help, I would guess.
No. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to spread out the truth with people. When I think it became so popular, so difficult. For example, the Draka, that everybody know about Draka, and it's not the truth word. But if you say that, it's so difficult that people first believe you, and second remember and use it. Because now it's too popular, the word Draka instead of Reiki.
Yeah, it's. I think okay. We've been going for an hour and 20 minutes, so we probably should.
We're having fun.
We probably should we'll start to wrap it up, and then we can carry on in the Q&A. So anybody who wants to hear more of this, the Q&A is every week. They're not always specifically just Q&A. It's more just an extension of the main show. It's just we kind of go over there, we carry on talking. They're a lot of fun. So you do get all of those on our Patreon, patreon.com/NordicMythologyPodcast, and you basically just get an extension of the episode, and you get all the back catalog on there. But Angie, the last question I wanted to put to you was, and it's probably quite a big one, how do we separate this?
What is this, Dan?
Well, runes from like the historically accurate side of runes from the magic. Obviously, we've been doing this podcast for so long now. The whole purpose of it is to try and put accurate information out there. And it still feels like it's just a drop in the ocean compared to the amount of misinformation that is out there. So like, how do we do it? It's a thing that's become so connected, and runes are so synonymous with magic now, as inaccurate as that is. How do we separate them? Do you have any ideas, or how would you do it?
For me, the most important thing is that do something like you do, like open the information, the right information to others, and help them to understand how to distinguish with the right information and the wrong information. So have, for me, the basic is understand what is a good information, what is not, what is a source and what is not a source. And then from there, just realize that you can use runes for magic, but doesn't mean that it is magical. Like we have findings, but you have to learn how to use the findings or the truth in the right way. Because sometimes you can take the truth, but you can interpret or sell it in a different way. Like for the divination, people say, yeah, but divination, there is Tacitus. Yeah, but he never mentioned
runes.
Well,
there are a bunch of issues with Tacitus.
Yes, he never mentioned runes. We don't know what it was. And so you have to be careful of what you take as a source or as a demonstration. So this is, it is very thin, the line, but when you get the line, when you understand how to make this line right, it's going to be easy.
Yeah, I think that's part of the issue is that most people aren't able to go back and read the original source. So everything is working off like secondhand information. So whether it's Tacitus or like Ibn Fadlan, like most people, even me included, like I've never read the original. So it's like,
That would be difficult.
Yes. Yeah. But so I'm then basing everything on somebody else's information or interpretation of that. Now, depending on who that person is, depends on how accurate the information is. So everything is kind of based on the secondhand knowledge because it's very difficult to then go back and just kind of find it. You're just kind of always quoting somebody else who's quoting somebody else who's quoting somebody else.
Yeah,
and
but the important thing is that nobody expected that everybody go to the sources because you have to study some languages and some technical to study the sources. But it's important that you trust that the person read the sources.
Yeah.
So not like a translation of the translation and then I interpret the translation of the translation. So go from a person that had a background studies on this. Like, I'm not an archaeologist, so I'm never going to teach archaeological findings, but maybe I can teach you about literary sources. So be careful of who you trust. You have to find a person that has the right knowledge and you can see if they're honest and say the truth. Or,
Wonderful.
That's a really, really good tip.
Mm-hmm. Be weary of anybody who pretends they know everything. I think we touched on it earlier. Anybody who isn't willing or doesn't say we don't know at some point in what they're
That's
writing.
Sketchy.
Yeah, it's usually sketchy. Anybody who's like, this is this, we know this, always take a wide berth of that. And yeah, I think that's a lovely way to wrap up the main show of just try and get back to somebody who has at least has a background in looking at the source. Because the amount of books that are written by non-runologists is unbelievable. It's the amount of rune books who are just written by the average person. But most people, again, they're not looking into the author. I think it's this trap of the people see a book, and a book's quite a powerful thing. It always has been. So they probably think that to get to this physical state of this book in this bookshop, it must have gone through some sort of checks and you know, publishing and editing to get here. It must have been checked. The accuracy must.
It's not.
So they, yeah, it's not. But unfortunately, I think books do just have this power, don't they? Where people pick them up and go, "Oh well, it's in this book here, so it must be true." And the person who's written it must have some understanding and some knowledge and some education. And that's unfortunately not the case.
It's kind of like a twist on the don't believe everything you read on the internet. It's like, just because it's published doesn't mean it's true.
Look always the bibliography. It's something that I suggest that always
look that it has a bibliography to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. Because sometimes it doesn't have. And if it has, you can see if they accurate or what book they rely on. And it is a beginning. It's not the final answer, but it's just a beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good way to start.
Perfect. Right. Let's wrap this up and let's take it over to the Q&A. I have some extra questions that I want to ask you in there as well. So Angie, thank you very much. Is there any way that you want to give a shout out for people to follow you? Anything you want to point people towards?
They can follow me on Instagram, because for now I don't have a website.
Okay.
Me neither, girl.
But Instagram is fine if they want to ask me things. I publish there what I'm doing.
What's your Instagram?
Oh, sorry. It's ng.erfur. But I can write maybe.
we will put it in the show notes. If you follow us on Instagram, again, not in Forge Podcast, you already should do, but you'll find it on there. We tag all our guests. We post upcoming episodes on there. We'll make sure people can find it and can find you. Mags, what about you?
Instagram as well. So it's ArchaeoMags, Archaeo with a K.
There we go. And then if you, for some reason, would like to follow me, it's Daniel underscore Farron 1 or Hornsboden, or obviously the podcast. You know what? I kind of messed up because I told myself, because so for anybody that doesn't follow my personal Instagram, I make like little reels, 90-second reels, educating people on different historical things. So I just did one on Helen Keller, who is one of the most fascinating people I've ever read about. Helen Keller was one of these people who I'd heard her name, and I kind of knew she was deaf and blind, but I didn't know anything about her. And then when I started to read about it, her story is absolutely fascinating. The lady who helped teach her to sort of understand language, Anne Sullivan, is also a beautiful human being. I thoroughly enjoyed creating it, but I committed myself to like doing a new reel every day, and it's fucking hard. There's a lot of research that has to go into it. For this 90-second reel, it takes a good couple of hours research and editing, but I love doing it, so I've committed to it. So anybody who does want to learn about silly little historical things, it's not
I
just...
was so happy that you did that reel episode, because I was very fortunate when I was young, and my dad bought like a bunch of like biographies of people in history written for kids. So he read, and I remember I loved that biography. So he kept, like, he read it multiple times. So I've known who Helen Keller was my entire life. And then I've met so many people who's like, what? And I'm like, how do you not know who Helen Keller is? Yeah. She was like the most amazing person. And then when I saw you did that real thing, I was like, finally.
It is. It's one of those things that I'd heard a name, and then as soon as I started reading it, I'm quite a emotional, soft-centered person. I couldn't stop crying reading about it, because it's just such a beautiful story of these two people who kind of went through her struggles and like the
figuring shit out.
Yeah, and they managed. So anybody who doesn't know, Helen
go
Keller
watch
was,
the reels.
Yeah, watch the reels. Yeah, nice one. Yeah, go watch them. I'm not gonna tell you. Fuck you. Go watch them.
No, but like, that's a good pitch. And also, like, I guess to wrap up this episode, would it be correct, Angie, to summarize it in a way of like, if you want to use runes for magical purposes yourself, that is fine. Just know that we don't necessarily know exactly how runes were used for magical purposes, if they even, or how that would go about themselves. And that doesn't mean that runes are magical in and of itself.
Yeah. You can use it in this way, but you summarize better.
Oh, well, then that's good. Yes, then I understood what you said. Yes. 10 points to Max.
No, wonderful. Let's wrap it up. Let's jump over to the Q&A. Let the patrons ask some questions. I'm sure they have some. Yep, there we go. And cut.